lessons. Now, the age bracket in general is from 12 to to 20, though the edges blur. You can have an adolescent going strong at 11, and you can have some people that never get out of their adolescence as far as that goes. Adolescence is generally considered to be a transition from childhood to adulthood. There have been some rather interesting studies made. A man named Friedenberg wrote a book called The Vanishing Adolescent, and he said what has really happened is that the adolescent era of life has been replaced by sort of a sub-teen culture. And this quiet time when you could grow up gradually at your own speed and go forward and then retreat and go forward again and retreat a bit, this has disappeared, and instead there's a cutoff, so that at about 13 or so, a child enters into a new stage, and he doesn't get out of it then until about 19 or 20. And in between, you have this tremendous generation gap, and the problem is that there is the youngster is really not in in a transition into your generation. He is in his own generation. And so you have the problem of trying to understand it. I think it helps to think of a youngster, adolescent, as a pioneer who's moving into a strange country. He's been warned about it. He's been encouraged. He's been frightened. He's been hopefully prepared. But he's never been there. And so he really doesn't know. He's been told, you know, the Indians will take your scalp, but he still has his scalp, and so he's not so sure that they'll take his. And he's been told that there's a drought ahead or there's going to be hard times, but that may happen to somebody else. It's not necessarily going to happen to him. And as he moves into this new country, then he takes with him all kinds of equipment. And where did he get his equipment? He got it from his childhood, and he got it from his home and family. And he has all kinds of questions, basic ones concerning his identity. Who am I? What do I expect of myself? What am I capable of doing? What is open to me? What is closed to me? How much shall I try new things? How much shall I stick to the things that I've been told are pretty safe and sound? Now, during this period, a number of things happen to the adolescent in terms of growth. Physically, he grows up. He reaches his full height and usually a corresponding gain in weight. There is sexual maturation, the ability to procreate. There's mental maturation, which, however, is a process. We've discovered now that one can continue to grow in his ability to grow, that is, his ability to handle new concepts and so forth, sometimes well into the late 20s, though I sometimes believe that there are people who have never thought a new thought or even considered thinking a new thought past the age of about 15. During this period, he acquires some self-judgment of his mental capacities, and he gets to understand himself. He says, I'm not going to take that course. I could never hack engineering. I don't think I would like the natural sciences and so forth, because he begins to know himself. Emotionally maturing, he enters into a process which hopefully will go on until the end of his life. Usually during adolescence, late adolescence, he reaches one goal, and that is the goal of emotional intimacy with one person of the opposite sex, which usually then ends up in a marital relationship. He makes decisions based on a philosophy of life, or he begins to make decisions. And I have, for alliterative purposes, made these all L's, or for good memory. He has to make decisions in the area of labor, and of love, and of loyalty, and of leisure. And when you sort of scan life, these are where the decisions are. What kind of work am I going to do? Whom am I going to marry? Where do my prime loyalties lie? Who is the lord of my life? And then finally, in our day, the question, what do I do with time? You know, leisure time. There are people who work three jobs, as the hours have been shortened on each one, simply to keep busy. They don't know what to do, you see, with their time. Now, the problem is that all of these things take place all at once. There's no orderly progression. You move out of emotional maturation into physical maturation, into intellectual maturation, and so forth. Consequently, on one day, a youngster is way out here, and the next day he's back again. In one area of life, he's far ahead of his class. In another area of life, he's way behind. So there are no norms, really. There are only very loose averages. And you cannot say, well, my child is super brilliant or super dull in this particular area, advanced or behind, because this will shift. He may be ahead in one area and behind in the other. Some days he wants very much to be an adult. Other days he wants and needs to be a child and to be cared for as a child. He can be a rank liberal one day and an extreme conservative the next. He can be an eager idealist and he can be a very reluctant coward. He wants to be an individual, but he wants to be an individual like all the other individuals that he knows. And so there's a certain conformity that you find in the adolescent age. And then all this takes place, you see, in the midst of a great deal of adult confusion. And he sees that if adults don't know the score, you know, and adults are no longer sure of values and where they're going and how they relate to others, maybe he never says it to himself, but instinctively, subconsciously, he picks up this, he gets the message pretty clearly, I'm moving into a very unsure world, this world of adulthood. Now, his relationships with his parents are probably going to be confused and probably going to be filled with a great deal of tension. I have said that it's the ability of the parent to train a child to leave home. And this training should begin the moment the child is born. Train him so that he can leave home without guilt or with as little guilt as possible and establish a home and a family of his own. And this means that a parent has the responsibility for cutting apron strings as soon as this is appropriate, and allowing the adolescent to think for himself and to feel for himself and to choose for himself. And yet how often does the parent respond when the child begins to do these things with, where in the world did you ever get such an idea? You know, with a strong cut to the tone of the voice. What are you moping about? It's not that important. You know, to whom? Well, you can't, and you can't because I say so. You know, God has spoken. It's a matter of allowing adolescents to make mistakes, but to be sure that they make their own mistakes and not simply those which we manipulate them into. Judgment, maturity is reached by making decisions, but it has to be a matter of their own decisions. It's quite possible for us to send kids off to camp or to college or someplace and give them a long list of instructions. Now, every Tuesday morning you do this, and every Thursday night you do that, and on Saturday, of course, you know the routine. Then the kid has to remember, you know, what I am supposed to do. Or we can send him off to camp with some basic principles in mind. You know, use your head, think twice on occasion, if there's time to think twice on it, and don't do anything that's going to hurt you too much. This business of allowing children to make decisions means that they're going to make mistakes. It's painful for them, but the chances are it's much more painful for the parent who forgets that he had to do the same thing himself, and that's the way that he grew. Now, there are special problem parents for children. And we are going to be problem parents if we have some things that we have not yet worked out. And again, at the subconscious level, the child will pick up the message that there is something here. If, for instance, we have neglected our own marital relationship and have invested everything in the children, the lack in the husband-wife relationship will become quite clear. If a parent has vicariously begun to live through a child, and I can recall, or I know a father, for instance, who has a little bitty kid, really, a small seven-year-old, and who is now drumming that kid into, you know, win, 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 has him reading books on the philosophy and the practice of how to play basketball and how to shoot baskets and how to, you know, be the star in Little League. It isn't fun. The father, obviously, you see, is just trying to relive his own athletic career because he's a fairly well-built man, and I suspect had some satisfactions here. Now he wants to go through the same thing again. And he's doing it through an alter ego. He's using this kid. If parents feel guilty about the quality of life that they're providing for the children, this is going to be picked up. If parents have leaned on their own parents too much so that they didn't develop a sense of self-sufficiency, if a parent panics at the thought of his own aging and his own death, this will be communicated to the parent. Now, or to the child. It was interesting as we checked bases here when we began to notice the widespread. Many of you here have children, you see, who are in their 20s. Some of you in their 30s. And also, it drops back, you see, into the 7-year-old, the 12-year-old, and so forth. I have two sons who are 24, another one 23, a daughter 14, and a little guy of 7. So I too have that same spread. How are we feeling about ourselves? Are we taking the stages of life easily? Are we prepared to live, to mature, and ultimately to die? These are things that our children will know about. Now, parents choose a number of ways in which to dominate their children. Sometimes we simply deny them the right to grow up, to earn money, to make decisions, to meet the other sex, to select a job. We keep them dependent. We can appeal to loyalty. I've done so much for you, and now look at what you're doing to me in return. We can undermine their self-confidence. Do you really think that's right when they've just told us, this is what I think I ought to do? Are you sure? It's something that we really have to watch, because that phrase, are you sure, the questioning, I think rationally we would justify it by saying, well, we really wanting to think it through. But what it really is, you see, I think in many cases is an expression of a mistrust of this judgment, of this decision that is reached. I know we have one sort of horrible example in our family when we sent one of our youngsters up to buy some pants one day, and he came back with the ghastliest pants that you have ever seen. We still refer to them as the ice cream pants because they looked like the flannel things you'd wear to an ice cream social in about 1921. And we made a mistake. You know, we discussed the kind of pants he bought, and we had him take them back. Or maybe we even took them back for him. I'm not so sure he wanted to go. And it has cropped up from time to time, not in any with any sharp overtones, but nevertheless it's there, you know, that this was a pretty traumatic experience and a pretty damaging one in the life of this young man. We can ply them with gifts which make them dependent. A young couple told me recently of the gifts which their parents were beginning to give them. No, they weren't a bottle of perfume at Christmas. It was a refrigerator, and it was a washing machine, and a new vacuum cleaner, and carpeting for the upstairs bedroom, and this kind of stuff. But they also knew what was going on, that they were being, you know, subtly being tied up so that they could never be in a position to say no. This amounts to bribery. I remember a man in my congregation where the parents gave the young couple the lot next door. Well, of course, that's cheap. It's nice to get real estate, but then you have to build next door, and then you have to live next door. And the sad outcome is that ultimately the marriage broke up, and a lot of it was just the fact that there was always somebody next door who knew what was going on. You see, it gets to be buying love. There have been many young couples who have waited years to establish their own family traditions because they always had to go back home for Christmas because mother and father would be so disappointed if the family didn't show up at Christmas time. And so the things that the mother and father are enjoying, you know, having their family around them at Christmas time, at holiday, other holiday periods, they deny to the children by insisting that they come back and always relate to the first family, forgetting that another one has broken off, has been cut off, and is now free to establish its own life together. How do how do adolescents feel within a family situation towards their parents and family and school? Well, in the first place, they're usually great reformers somewhere along the line. For years, you know, they've been the most untidy individuals that you can find, leaving the room in a mess and so on. And then suddenly they turn on the family and they want to put everyone straight. A mother should be more tidy. Brother shouldn't cry so much. Father should give up those dull jokes he's always telling. A sister ought to read better books and so on. The furniture is worn out. The car, I mean, we're ashamed to drive in it, you know, to go downtown. We never get the table setting right. It's always sort of sloppy and thrown together. And your only hope at this point is to recognize that it will taper off and ultimately it will stop. It will come as he recognizes that there are other individuals who do differ from him, and as he accepts his own limitations in his ability to reform the world. There is an excellent book by William Glasser, a California psychiatrist, called Reality Therapy. It's easy to read. Glasser developed his therapy in working with adolescent girls in the Ventura School for Girls, which is a sort of a delinquent home for delinquent and pre-delinquent girls, and then also in the senile wards of the Veterans Hospital. And he simply faces people with the reality. And sometimes we have to do that with our own children and say, but these are the limitations, you know, of our home, of our finances, of our patients, and so forth, and you better learn to live with it. You do not live with your aunt, who's so sweet and kind. You do not live with grandma. You live with me. And that's part of the reality of life. The sooner you learn to live and adjust to me, to us, to our family, the happier you are going to be. It's good, I think, to involve them in family matters, and they will involve themselves to some extent, at least in terms of demands. If we can involve them in realistic and sensible decisions, it helps. Time schedules, finances, even vacation plans, cars. They will push for more. They will push for more independence than we are ready to give them usually. But if we can involve them somehow in the decisions, this helps. Each generation has a different set of problems, and the parental anxiety usually comes at the point of moral anxieties, moral issues. And this is going to be particularly difficult if we have not resolved these moral issues in our own makeup. If we have a problem of dependence upon one another that is more than it should be, if we have a problem of dependence upon with our parents, if we have not worked out a salutary and happy sexual adjustment in our marriage, if our work life is unhappy, if vocational choices are still griping us, we are going to have some difficulties here in helping our children through their problems. Adolescents are extremely critical. Studies have been made about high school students, and they 60% of them, for instance, listed these things as issues in the home, or the things that these were their gripes, their criticisms of their parents' criticisms. I guess that's the best way to put it. They said, we're always getting bugged about table manners and our habits, and having some other sibling in the family held up as an example, and marks, and the automobile, and eating what's good for you, and where does all your money go, and things of this sort. And interestingly enough, and maybe to be expected, I don't know, girls have more complaints at this point than boys. They say they're getting bugged at more points by their parents than even the fellows are. As far as his religious life, the adolescent, by and large, is an honest person, and he will not tolerate too much dishonesty. He will not tolerate much of any, and he will be able to see through the religious life, which really doesn't mean much. If we preach love and do not practice love, we're not going to be of much help to him. The adolescent does not build his faith on abstract statements. He is really not too much interested in creeds or in doctrinal positions. He is not interested in what can be memorized. He is interested in what he can do, how he can express his life. He will either hold on to religion, if he sees religion as sort of empty, as a form, he will hold on to it, buy the whole bit, lock, stock, and barrel, and move into a defensive position about it, or else he's apt to chuck the whole business completely if he is more of an honest and a free individual. The growth in his religious life is going to come only as he meets some opposition to what he's been told. Do you really think that what you taught your seven-year-old is going to get him through high school? Or what you teach a youngster in high school is going to get him through the first 2 years of marriage? You see, there has to be some growth that takes place in one's spiritual life. He's going to move along. He's going to hit new ideas. He's going to come across different phraseology. He's going to have a roommate at college who looks at him and says, "Do you believe that stuff still?" And this is a shaking experience, to be challenged at the core of your life, and to realize that the man who is challenging you, or the person who is challenging you, has probably done a lot more current thinking, or is doing a lot more current thinking about this question than you are. So we really have to give them some help. And I think we can help them particularly if we allow them to see that faith is not something that is uniform in all situations, and it applies to other people. That other people have different points of view, and other people have different approaches to things, and other people have different religious outlooks and are really of a different religious caste. That means, you see, it tells him that he too can be different, and that if his faith is challenged, so what? The other fellow may not be any more right than he, or as was pointed out the other night, they both may be wrong, but at least they are free to develop as persons at this stage of life. Now, one of the problems in the development of youngsters growing up is this business of discipline. How do you develop an inner balance? Discipline is not punishment. Punishment is something all by itself, and you have to understand what you're doing with punishment before you exercise it. But discipline is a different matter. It's a matter of being a disciple, of leading someone along, leading him into something that is salutary, that is going to be good for him. I don't think that there are any single absolute answers. I know there aren't, as far as discipline is concerned, because we're dealing with so many different children. It's many different situations. And there is no single answer for you, for your single child at this time, that you can say, now I've got the answer, because tomorrow he's moved into a different phase of his development, or tomorrow he's in retreat from where he was today. And so the idea is rather to have an armamentarium of things that you can use, of principles that you can apply, of escape hatches into which you can dive on occasion. One principle that I think makes good sense is to be firm plus gentle, to put firmness together with gentleness, not toughness with softness. Firmness indicates that you have a position and you can defend it, and so you can explain it. You can be gentle about it because you don't have to beat anyone over the head. You don't have to jam anything down their throats. One phrase that I've used for a long time in this area and have tried to share with as many people as I can is the concept of correcting without criticism. It's very, very difficult to do. The moment we become We see something that we don't like, it's threatening normally. And so we then get an edge to our voice, and we have to come down pretty hard on the individual. He's about to make a mistake, And so the only way to make a mistake, you see, is to throw a roadblock that's so big or so threatening or so dangerous that he will forevermore not go in that direction. I think as parents we get hung up too much on this idea that the thing that happens today is going to mark the child forever. So your child is reported in second grade is stealing the chalk or stealing someone's crayons. It does not mean that unless you do something to his fingers or his inner person by late Tuesday, that he's embarked upon a criminal career. And yet we panic at this point. I think we have to recognize that the pressures of parent or the firmness is something that you can hit, but you don't shatter against it. It's almost like a surface that is covered, a hard surface that is covered with something that is protective. The aim is to protect the person or the object that comes against the hardness that's behind it. Actually, how we say something can be far more important than what we say. The tone of voice that we employ. Sometimes it would be very good for us as parents simply to raise questions about how we raise our voices and how often we raise them. The law of retaliation really doesn't develop any inner disciplines. When someone said, you're going to punish me now, or all you do is punish me, really it comes back, you see, as if we're getting our talons into them, because this is where the word comes. We are striking back, we are clawing once more because we have been clawed. And if a parent gets into this kind of a tit-for-tat relationship with his youngster, he's in difficult ground. You no longer have a place, you see, upon which to stand, from which you can speak. Oftentimes when we talk with our children, we choose the wrong moments. I think it is important to look for moments of receptivity, to look for the proper time to speak, to try to catch a child when he's open to what you say. What's the point of banging his ears when he has just stopped them off completely? Really, nothing is accomplished. See, do you want to punish? Do you want to get your point of view across? Do you want to get all your feelings out? Or do you wish to educate, wish to bring this child along? Nothing is going to call out infantile responses more quickly from children than wholesale condemnations. How often do we say, you always do this? And they don't, and we know it. And we expect that they know that we know it. But the phraseology, kids are very, very sensitive at that point. Children have a highly honed sense of justice. One of the problems that I have as a dean of students in a college is to try to be fair, because you're still in your late adolescent period, and this sense of fairness and treating me the same way as someone else is treated. And when you say you always, or even when you say you kids, you see, and you lump someone along with the whole group or with a group, then you have denied their individuality, and you have not given them a chance to deal with the issue. Because by that time, they're all uptight about the fact that they have been attacked as a person, and the issue sometimes just goes down the drain. I mentioned earlier this matter of trying to involve them in the decisions or in the solutions. One of the prime stories that I heard in terms of its value is the story of a family, father, mother, and two daughters. And the question came up about hours. They had family conferences from time to time. The question came up on hours, since they were now in high school, and the daughters insisted that there should be no hours, that you had to come in. You could come in when you wished. And so the parents went along with it. And so the next Saturday night, at 11 o'clock, one of the girls came in and the other one came in at 12:15, and Dad was sitting up, and they said, where's Mother? And he said, well, I don't know. She isn't in yet. And at 1 o'clock, she wasn't in, and at 3 o'clock, she wasn't in, And everyone else was still up, you know, waiting for her mother to show up. And finally, about 4:30 in the morning, she came. And there was another conference. And the family decided that maybe it did make sense, after all, to have some rules so that everybody could go to sleep at night with a little more peace of mind. This is what I mean about involving them, helping them to see the implications, you see, of some of these factors. Children don't, when I say children, I'm talking about this teenage group now, adolescents. Normally they do not have much of a sense of worry, that is, about other people's worries and anxieties. What they can see is the fact that, you know, I'm alive, I know where I am, why should you be worried about me? And so if there are ways in which you can communicate the fact that we do have concerns and we do worry, this can best be done by involving them into the mix of the family. Development of self-discipline, you see, does not involve getting them to do it our way. One of the real problems which we face as parents is recognizing that our children are going to have different values than we are. And they're going to do things, they're going to have a lifestyle that may be different from our own. There have been many parents who have been unnecessarily, I think, turned off or have turned away from their children because they don't dress the way we want them to dress, they don't cut their hair the way we want them to cut their hair, etc., etc., etc. And in this process of insisting that they do things, dress alike, have our lifestyle, what happens is that we run the risk of losing the person. It seems to me this is the most important value in the whole situation. We should make every effort to support the developing ego, the sense of importance, the sense, I'm not talking now about egotism. I'm talking about the sense of being of value. Maslow has developed a whole system, what he calls a hierarchy of values. And he says the first one that a person needs, or in terms of security, is he just needs to be alive. He needs to be provided for. Well, that's food. And then he said the second one is he needs to be secure. He needs to be protected from danger. And this makes sense. Then you come to the critical one, and that is he needs to have a sense of self-esteem. And if this third one is missing, then really there is going to be no significant progress from then on. So this third point is the place where as we discipline, as we deal, as we differ, as we argue, as we love our children, we should develop as much insight as we can into the fact that they are developing persons who must become self-confident, even in the midst of some of the defeats, or especially in the midst of some of the defeats that they're going to get. And so we're flexible, we support the healthy, functioning parts of the ego, and help them to work on some of those that aren't functioning as well. Now, in terms of discipline, there are some little ground rules. One is we can simply shift our techniques. First, the thing that is working in dealing with your children, continue to use it. Don't read a new book and then chuck out what's working. But secondly, you shift your technique a little bit when something isn't working, and you discover that you may get some results. And then there are the moments when you stop trying because it's not working, and at the moment you have no other solutions. You have no other ideas as to what should work. And so you simply ride it out. There's a certain momentum that gets built into a family. There are emotional feelings that are pretty deep. It's amazing how many girls who were raised in meticulous homes go away to college and are the sloppiest housekeepers in the whole dormitory. And when they are married, once more the role of a homemaker, or when the role of a homemaker is assumed, they then jump back past those 4 or 5 years, you see, and become very good housekeepers themselves, because they picked up these impressions as they grew up. So don't give up simply because you're not communicating. Don't despair because nothing seems to be happening at the moment. It may well begin to happen later on. It may well happen when someone else, some other influence, gets involved. And that's my next point. Don't hesitate to go for outside help. If you need it, if you're just not being able to get through, then look for help. It may be professional counseling. Maybe a pastor who has some insight and some skills in this area. It may well not be the pastor. He may be too much your ally, and the child may sense or perceive or believe that he's just being sent there to talk to the pastor to be told that he's supposed to obey his parents. And so nothing's happening. You may have to go to some professional help, an objective third person who can give you some assistance. You should stop trying when the relationship is threatened. When there's withdrawal, when there's evasion, when there is staying away, when there's depression, when there's falsehood, when there's no communication, when there's a preoccupation, when there's a loss of spontaneity in living, in relating to you, this is a good time to realize that the relationship itself is threatened. A man came to see me about 2 months ago. His son was dropping out of college, and he was very much upset about it. The relationships had not been good there for a long time. But we talked for a half an hour or so, and what I tried to communicate to him was that, yes, his son was going to drop out of college. It was pretty clear that he wasn't going to make it. There was no sense in denying it. He had not learned study habits, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It went on for a long list of things. And I said, you can condemn him and you can make him feel very inferior because he can't handle college at this moment. Maybe later on he'll do very well. But I said, the most important thing is that you keep the relationship alive. Otherwise, you're going to lose your son. And I think that's what we have to remember. The battles, the arguments of the day are relatively unimportant compared to the relationship and the things that have been built into the sense of we love you, and well, while we admit we don't understand and simply cannot buy everything that you do, nevertheless we respect you as a person. So when the relationship is threatened, then back away, stop trying. Another symptom of this is when we do all the talking, the phone is off the hook, go on and on and on, nothing ever comes back, then back away from the situation. Sometimes, as parents, we go beyond where we should have gone, and we're really out of bounds, and when we're most honest, we recognize it. When we begin to read the mail that comes, we're out of bounds. We wouldn't take that, you see, ourselves. We would consider that as an absolute invasion of our privacy. And yet we justify it. The end justifies the means. We only mean well. And we justify doing something that's really quite nefarious and beneath our dignity because we are so concerned. And I'm not sure that perhaps there are times when this can be justified, but I think there are very, very few. When we are out of bounds, when we recognize that we are trying to determine what another person should be instead of letting him determine what he wants to be himself. When we do this, we have to back away, take another look at ourselves. And then back away when we have had it, or hopefully before we've had it. And while there's still some spontaneity and some life, new living possibilities within us, perhaps we can't help at the moment. But there are others who can. There are teachers who are influential. How many neighbor kids can you talk to who can't talk to their own parents? But you can. You can say the thing. You can be the parent surrogate, the substitute parent, for somebody else at this time. Sometimes it's good to send them off to their uncle's farm or to visit an aunt or an older sister or brother or something. Let them get out of your hair. Don't feel guilty, because at this particular moment, you can't be the one. You can't. So going back to Glasser's reality therapy, accept the reality of the moment and don't beat yourself over the head and feel guilty about it. You do what you can. Your job as a parent, you see, with your children is to build bridges, don't burn them. So we don't end up, we should not be constantly giving ultimatums and then following through on the ultimatums which have burnt a bridge. Rather, we should constantly be trying to extend it. When the Army Corps of Engineers puts out a pontoon bridge, it starts, you know, from one bank. There may be a fairly swift stream flowing there, and then they get one more section out, one more section. It may be that something comes down and sends it down the river, but they simply start over again. And eventually, you see, section to section by section, you're going to be able to get across. Now, what you are able to send on that bridge, you know, it may be a very light, thin, frail bridge, but if you got the bridge, be grateful for it. Send what you can. Adolescents, I have discovered, are oftentimes, they need affection and love, but they don't need it overtly. Sometimes they can't take it overtly. I think it's very good when your children are growing up to touch them, to love them, to muss up the hair of a youngster. It's a good feeling for him, and there's too little of this, to hold them close. You may find that when you reach, when someone in your family's reached a certain age, though, that he won't take this anymore, or she won't, to the extent that they will find, continue it. They are sometimes embarrassed by displays of affection. I think, I know that they need the basic love, but it's the display of the affection. You see, there's a difference here that can make it difficult for them to relate. Children need a genuine love. Erich Fromm says in his little classic book, The Art of Loving, that people go insane when they aren't loved, or that people who are insane are that way because they have no one to love and no one who loves them. I recall going through a mental institution a long time ago, mental hospital, in which the people there had reverted so far back that they were simply coiled up in a fetal position, curled up in a fetal position, had completely withdrawn from any contact, you see, with life, with people. And it was a tragedy. So give them as much genuine love as you can, and genuine freedom, and surround them with a genuine faith in your home. And then one almost has to say, you know, God go with you, because I can't go with you wherever you're going. Now, why don't you, we have just about 10, 12 minutes left. Anything that you would want to...